Sam, can you share with us something you did today that was good for your well-being?
I'm not sure I did anything. I work 1 or 2 days a week as a doctor, and today I got up at 5:30 in the morning, sleep deprived, because my wife and I stayed up late last night to watch Netflix, so I didn't get enough sleep. I woke up this morning, and I also was saying, morning man hates night man. So at night when my wife and I say, one more episode, one more episode, one more episode, we always have this saying, morning man is going to hate night man. And in the morning at 5:30 when my alarm went off, I thought, oh, morning man so hates night man right now. And I rode a motorbike out of Borkham Hills. It was freezing. I worked non-stop as a doctor. Like, it was just go, 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 go. Every case didn't go the way we wanted it to go. So we were meant to finish at 3 or 4. I thought I'd make it here easily on time. I had to scrub out of the last case, and a nurse took over, and I said to her, now, don't make me look bad. Don't make this look too easy. Then they know how ordinary I am. And I just jumped on a motorbike. I've been on the M whatever. like a 90, 100K an hour. Took a wrong exit, so I missed the Carl Expressway. And I've just jumped in. I cannot believe that 40 minutes ago I was holding a leg at Borkham Hills in a hospital. It's like I've just stepped in a time machine, and here I am. And so I'm just a little bit disorientated.
No worries.
But tomorrow for well-being, I was going to go for a surf, but I've just looked at the surf report and it's flat, even too flat for someone like me. Because normally I go and it just says 1 foot, too small, do not bother. That is my day. That is my range, 1 to 2 foot. But apparently tomorrow is zero. So I'm not going to get any well-being in the next 24 hours either.
Now, you've just disclosed to us that you're a doctor.
Yeah.
And you're going to be speaking about physical and mental well-being.
Yeah.
So, would you like to make any disclaimers?
Okay, so there are many sorts of doctors, right? And I work in the orthopedic area, which is the bone doctor side of things, and we know nothing about anything. Like if you think about it, we're so specialized in bones, and for us, it's the knee and the hip joint, not the elbows, not the hands, not the ankles. And so I may sound like I know what I'm talking about, but I'm not an expert, because even though I have the title doctor, it's a very, very narrow area. But I was in between work 4 or 5 years ago, and I thought, I'm going to be a personal trainer. So I signed up and I did the TAFE course to Cert 3 for sports and fitness or whatever. And I did 2 out of 6 modules and I dropped out. So I'm a TAFE dropout. I couldn't get it done. So I have my full admiration to anyone out there with a Cert 3, Cert 4 in anything. You have more drive, more ambition, and more application and execution than I have.
Okay, so what you're saying is you're not an expert on
No,
everything,
no.
But you probably do know a bit more than.
Maybe, I don't know.
No, like, sure speaking.
All right.
And the last question I wanted to ask you.
Sure.
You've also got a doctorate in theology.
Yes.
And we were having a conversation around that because it's actually hard to explain what that is.
Yeah.
And I think we came up with it's about exploring the big ideas of the Bible. Now, why have you done a doctorate in that? Do you know what I mean? That's a
Yeah,
lot
I
to
know. Right. So I gave up medicine. Then I had mission creep. I gave up full-time medicine about 20, 30 years ago. I did a certificate in the Bible. That was 1 year. Then I did a 3-year bachelor degree in the Bible. Then I went to Chicago, did a 1 or 2 years master's in the Bible. Then I did a 5-year PhD in the Bible. And the whole time, my parents, who are funding it, goes, what is theology? And they're wondering what that is too. And so theology is studying just the big ideas and the big themes of the Bible, and looking at ideas of the world as well, through a Christian Bible world lens. So something like well-being is a word you might not find in the Bible, but it's an idea you find in the Bible. So that's what theologians do. We study ideas, not necessarily the words.
Well, I might hand over to you.
Sure.
And we've left a whiteboard here for Sam because this is his comfort blanket.
Yes,
Really?
yes.
Okay, thanks.
All right. So, have you explained how tonight's going to run? Like, I'm going to do a segment on physical well-being. You've done all that.
No, but thank you for reminding
Yeah, so
me.
what we're going to have right now is a 10 or 15 minute segment on physical well-being. Well, I'll talk for a little while and open up to you guys for question and answer. And then we're going to break. and then we're going to do the same thing for mental well-being, and then we'll have a break, and we'll do the same thing for spiritual well-being. All right, so we're going to cover physical well-being for the next 10 or 15 minutes. I'll talk for 5 or 10 minutes, and then you guys can have a time for question and answer, and they'll make up the 15 minutes. So several key things for physical well-being, and really, no surprises. It's sleep. It's the way we eat, so food or diet, and it's exercise. And what we're after is a lifestyle change. So everyone makes that New Year's resolution every year, this year, I'm going to eat less, drink less, and exercise more. And we get up at 5 in the morning, we go for a run, we sign up for a gym, but we give up after 1 month because it's unsustainable. What we need is a lifestyle change, not just an event we tack onto our busy lives. We actually have to change our lives, our lifestyle. So something, let me talk about sleep. A year or two ago, I went to some seminar and it was all about the peak performance pyramid. So you want to be working well, if you want to be thriving, flourishing, if you want to be a good parent, a good partner, a good whatever, they talked about the peak performance pyramid. And it was shaped like a pyramid and it had all these layers. And you had to do this well, this well, this well, this well, this well. There was relationships, there was this, there was that. But the very bottom layer was sleep. Before you can do any of these things well, you need to sleep. You need to get enough sleep. And as you know, the REM cycle goes for about 45 minutes for most people, plus or minus 5 or 10 minutes. And they estimate that we, to make sure we get enough REM cycles, we need to err on the safe side. We actually every night need 9 hours of sleep. And already we know we're not getting that because of the light bulb, because of devices, because of work, because of emails. But really, that's what we need to aim for. And I know there are one or, and if that's too hard, what you got to do is just dedicate 2 days a week. Okay, that's going to be they're the 2 days I'm going to make sure I get my 9 hours. And so I actually pre-schedule with my wife. I say, hey, tonight, I don't care what happens. I got to be in bed at 9 o'clock. And if you do it, next morning when you wake up going, oh, this is what it feels like to get enough sleep. Oh my gosh, this is what it feels like. And signs that you're getting enough sleep, the number one sign is you wake up before the alarm clock goes off. Like your body knows it, you set it at 6, you'll wake up at 5:55. The alarm clock should not be waking you up. You should be able to wake yourself up if you get enough sleep. Signs you're not getting enough sleep would be falling asleep in a seminar. No matter how boring a seminar is, you should not fall asleep. You should be able to endure it. It might be boring, but if you fall asleep, you're not getting enough sleep. That's a sign. Also, if we get less than 7 hours of sleep, we're 3 times as likely to catch the cold. So once we get less than 7 hours sleep, our body gets stressed. When we get stressed, we put out the stress hormone, which is cortisol. Cortisol dampens your immune responses. So you're more likely to get sick, get a cold, get infections. Cortisol is also a weight gaining hormone. So if we don't get enough sleep, we naturally put on weight. So if we want to get fit, it sounds counterintuitive, like if I'm in bed, I'm not burning any calories. Yes, but if we're not in bed, we're producing cortisol. Cortisol is also, it increases injuries. So if you're training for marathons or things like that, you're going to increase your chance of muscle tear, ligament tear, things like that. So, sleep. We need to make sure we get enough sleep. That's the first thing. Let me talk about food. When I was at university in the 1980s, we heard about the food pyramid. It's always the pyramid, and it was carbs on the bottom, proteins in the middle, fats on top. You know, it's maximize your carbs. Okay, moderate protein, minimal fats. But as you know, the pyramid's been inverted now. And so now it's all about trying to go no carbs or low carbs. And carbs, you know, sugars, processed flours, whatever. And now have a diet of proteins. So that's your chicken, your fish, your beef, your nuts, healthy fats, so avocados, even dairy, things like that. So I, for the last 2 or 3 years, I've performed what I call a life hack or a body hack. I have done the lifestyle change. So this is my routine now. I try to aim for no carbs, no carbs. And of course, 10 or 20 grams will sneak in somewhere. But if you aim for 10 or 20 grams, you're going to get 50 grams. You aim for 50 grams, you're going to get 100 grams. So to be social, I might have a toast with you. I might have a muffin with you to be social, all right? But in my day, I will try to aim for zero carbs. And I think so far I've had no carbs except for a wrap or something like that, okay? That's the only carbs I've had. I aim for chicken, fish, healthy fats, avos, dairy, and leafy greens. People argue about legumes. So that's beans, peas, peanuts. So I reckon, you know, just a moderate amount of legumes is all right. So this is my life hack. I've changed my food pyramid. I've inverted it. I only eat one or two meals a day. So I think once you pass 30, your metabolism slows so much, you actually only need one or two meals a day. So I think one of the reasons why we're struggling with fitness is we're eating three meals, which is probably too much for a 30-year-old body and above. So when you're 18, you're always needing energy. So that's why you need your three meals. I don't know how much you guys know about this, but I try to stay in what's called the keto zone. Is this new area for most of you people now? All right. So when we were eating carbs, and think about it, as a species, carbs came late in the human species because we had to domesticate plants to get carbs. So this was what we used to eat early on as a human species. These have come late. So it's like our species isn't used to this. So, but because we ate a lot of carbs, carbs get stored as glycogen. Our body gets used to burning glycogen for fuel. And when I used to play rugby for Sydney University, and when I used to do marathons, I've done 5 marathons, we were told to carb up, have glycogen in your body's fuel. Trouble is, there's only 2 hours worth of glycogen in your body. That's why you hit the wall at the 2-hour mark in a marathon. Now you need energy gels. But if you don't have carbs, you train your body to burn the fat in your body. And the fats then produce ketones, and then your body burns ketones for fuel. So I've actually retrained my body not to need carbs, not to need glycogen. And so there are days I can wake up, ride a push bike to Westmead Hospital from where I live, which is a 20K ride, work all day as a doctor, not feel hungry, ride the push bike back, and then just eat one meal for dinner, because I've trained my body to access the fat in my body and also the ketones. So I don't want to push you guys in an eating disorder, but just to say, this is the life hack. So today I try to typically skip breakfast, have lunch and have dinner using those things. And the final life hack then is exercise. I exercise every day. If you aim for every day, it becomes 5 days a week. If you aim for 5 days a week, it'll be 3 days a week. So aim for every day, it'll be 5 days a week. And it's first thing in the morning on an empty stomach when you're most glycogen deprived, forcing your body to go into the keto zone and the fats. And look it up, high intensity interval training. So I used to run marathons and I used to put on weight running marathons because I was carbing up and the stress of the exercise was putting cortisone in my system, which made me put on weight. But now I'm doing high intensity interval training. I just aim for 5 to 15 minutes every day, every morning on an empty stomach with some coffee on board because the coffee fires up the metabolism. And I go for a system called Tabata. So just look it up. It's 20 seconds on, 10 seconds off. So 20 seconds of body weight exercise, like 20 seconds of push-ups, 10 second break. 20 seconds of chin-ups, 10 second break. 20 seconds of sit-ups, 10 second break. 20 seconds of a squat, 10-second break, and I do that for 5, 10, or 15 minutes. And I, so that's how I've life hacked, body hacked, but that's all I want to say for physical well-being, sleep, food, and exercise, in that priority maybe. All right, any questions? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. But then you've managed to make quite a sustainable body hack or like that. How did you get that consistency?
Oh, because it wasn't something. I'll repeat the question. I mentioned on the one hand, every New Year's we make these resolutions and they're unsustainable, but it seems like I have made resolutions and they have been sustainable. I think because with the New Year's resolutions, we think it's an event we can add to our life without our life actually changing. So it could be like, I got to wake up at 5 and go for a run, when normally you would wake up at 7. So now you're forcing yourself to get up 2 hours earlier than you normally would. Or I'm going to sign up for the gym, when normally the gym had never been part of your lifestyle. So now you're trying to work out, well, how do I squeeze gym into my life? Do I go before or after work? So what I'm doing is I'm not adding something to my lifestyle. I'm actually changing this. This is my life now. So I told my wife, this was about 2 years ago, I'm only eating twice a day now. And so you don't have to make me breakfast, or it could have been breakfast and lunch. So dinner, I said, I'll sit with you guys, like with you and the kids, but I'll just eat the broccoli because they're just to be social. Just so dad's not sitting at the table, not eating. And I guess instead of breakfast, I changed it. So it's not so I didn't have to wake up earlier to exercise. Instead, when I would have been eating breakfast, now I'm doing this. I think because it's not something I have to wake up earlier for or go to after work for. They're not being added to my lifestyle. My life itself changed.
But how did you really stick with that? Because, I mean, people say, oh, I'm going to quit smoking, and that's a subtraction rather than an addition to their schedule.
Mm.
It's so hard. Or if I sat there around the table and everyone was eating cake, and I promise not to eat cake, I tried it pretty damn hard to... Is that a God-given strength, or
really? I just think. I have no idea why it was so easy. I think it's what you want to do. I remember reading this book where people say, "Oh, I so want to do that," but then they don't. And the book basically said, "Well, actually, you don't want to do it." Then, the fact that you didn't do it means you really deep down didn't want to give up smoking or give up whatever or add this or do this. Yeah, I think the benefit, like, you know, well, that's it. So there's this, it's the, what they call, you know, there's a stimulus behavior reward. So you've performed this behavior and instantly you've been rewarded. You think, wow, I feel great. I have energy. I'm back to what I weighed when I was at university. So I'm fit. So there's this incredible benefit. So to create a habit, so a bad habit is an addiction. A good addiction is a habit, a good habit. What's his name? Charles Duhigg has a book called The Power of Habit. So you just got to recognize the habit cycle. There's a stimulus, there's a behavior, and there's a reward. So you got to create a stimulus for this. So my stimulus for this is I'm going to make myself a coffee in the morning. As I drink the coffee, that's my stimulus now to exercise. So I've created a stimulus. So whereas my friends who go for a run in the morning, their stimulus is they put their shoes out, their running shoes out. And then they have this funny little mantra where they say, I'm going to put my shoes on, but I'm not going to go for a run. Okay, I'm just going to go to the front door, but I'm not going to go for a run. I'm just going to go out the front gate, but I'm not going to go for a run. Oh, okay, I'm going for a run. But that's their stimulus. And the same way, it's the same way you break a bad habit. So let's say you find yourself every Friday night in front of the TV drinking too much wine. You think, oh, I've done it again. I've drunk a bottle of wine. I promised myself I wouldn't do this, but I've done it again. Well, you've got to recognize the stimulus. What is the stimulus? It's Friday night in front of the TV. That's your stimulus. Your behavior is you're drinking wine. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but this is a habit you're wanting to break. And you're being rewarded. You feel great. You're not running the TV. That's why you've got this habit. So what you're meant to do is recognize the stimulus. It's Friday night. I'm in front of the TV. This is going to make, you got to replace the behavior. So drink green tea instead. And Charles Duhigg says, you'd be surprised, you'll almost get the same reward. Hey, I feel great. I feel great about myself. I'm drinking green tea in front of the TV on a Friday night. Yeah. Carol, you have to keep time. I forgot when I...
Yeah. Maybe one more minute.
One more, yep.
What is the body reaction to fat, like eating pork or something?
The body's reaction... What, question, what is the body's reaction to...
Eating
fat. They used to think it was bad. Now they think it's a good source of energy. So I'll tell you how it's all been replaced. So you got to think about 20 or 30 years ago, people were having heart attacks, strokes, and then you look in the arteries and they're clogged with cholesterol plaques. So you think, oh, it's cholesterol causing the plaques. It's fat. So we can just cut out fat. And if people are fat and overweight and it's fat, fat's the problem. Now they realize it's sugar that's the problem. So the high sugar in your blood is causing damage to the arteries, which allows the fat to then build up. So the fat is secondary to the primary problem, the high sugars. Also, where was I going with this? So they think the reason why America has the obesity epidemic is with all the low-fat foods they created to make up for the mouthfeel, they had to add high sugar. So that's why they've all put on weight. Ironically, with a low-fat diet, they've all put on weight. They've also discovered that a calorie is not a calorie. So we all got taught, it's simple maths. You eat 40 calories, now you need to burn 40 calories. Doesn't matter whether the calories come from chips, peanuts or ice cream. I mean, it's mathematical, you know, conservation of mass and energy. Now they realize, no, 40 calories from sugar, bah, is bad. That is 40 calories of sugar. 40 calories, but 40 calories in good fats like nuts and avocados, your body actually doesn't absorb all 40. Because it's having to break it down and it lets a lot go because it's all caught up in the complex fibers and whatever. And if you eat potatoes, which are high carbs, starchy, it makes you more hungry. Like, so chips will make you more hungry. But if you eat the same amount in nuts, it will make you less hungry and you filled yourself up with good fats. So fats are good because they make you feel full and satiated and you don't crave, you know, the sugars and the, so, yeah. Okay, one more question, sure.
Good, so basically you chose this diet, one benefit is weight.
Are there other benefits? Okay, so I've definitely been able to get rid of like just the fat mass I've been carrying around for the last 20, 30 years, and I couldn't run it off with marathons, couldn't get rid of it with rugby. So that was one benefit. But I think the next benefit is, this is really weird, but I don't get hungry and I don't run out of energy and I don't get tired because my body is just burning fats, which is a dense energy source, producing ketones, which I now access as energy. So you guys can look into this. I don't want to create an eating disorder, so gotta, but this is what's worked for me. And intuitively, many people are discovering the same thing. And so some people are calling it the 16-8 diet. You eat for 8 hours of the day, you fast for 16 hours a day. So intuitively, this is what I've stumbled upon. And my friends have just stumbled upon it as well. Some of my friends in a 5-1-1 diet, so you eat like this for 5 days, you fast for 1 day, create a famine, and then you feast for 1 day. So that's a day you allowed your carbs. So have your pizzas, have your rice, have your spaghetti. So we're doing mental health now. I have a friend who I went through Bible college with, we're in the same sort of field, and then he said suddenly last year he found himself, he could not will himself onto a train because basically he was having a panic attack, anxiety. I have another friend, similar profession of mine. He does a lot of public speaking. He was going to catch a plane and fly to, I think, Brisbane. Friend of his drove him to the airport. And then when they go to the airport, my friend was curled up in a fetal position in the passenger seat, could not get out of the car to catch the plane to go to the conference he was speaking at. And so every day I ask myself, is today the day I can't get on a plane or train? Like, how do I make sure this doesn't happen to me? So I have to perform a lot of self-monitoring and just be aware of where I am, like stress mental-wise. Let me paint a scenario for you. I went to med school in the 1980s. I worked as a doctor at Westmead Hospital on call in the early 1990s. And we used to carry pagers around with us. So if you wanted us, let's say I was the doctor you had to call because an accident's come in a hospital, but I'm not home. So I'm driving on my car on the freeway and my pager would go off. It was a simple Motorola and it just went red. Beep, 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 which I knew meant I had to ring the hospital switchboard. So now I have to look for an exit off the freeway. And then I'm driving around in the suburbs of Homebush, Flemington, looking for a public phone. Then I find a public phone. I pull out my Telstra preloaded card, which I bought at a newsagent, put it in. I dial Westmead Hospital, and I'm on hold for like 10, 15 minutes. And finally say, hi, I'm Sam Chan. I'm the orthopedic registrar on call tonight. Someone paged me. And I go, huh, I'll see who that is. And then they'll give you a number to call. You call that number and it'll ring dead. And so then you're stuck on a public phone for half an hour. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is for an utter emergency back then, it took an hour before someone could contact you. And the most important department was in the intensive care unit, ICU. And when the consultant went home, they said, oh, if it's an emergency, you can get us on the bat phone, which was this thing the size of a car battery, which had a phone. What I'm trying to say, that was the mobile phone in the 1990s, and there was only one of them for the whole hospital, and you had to be the most important doctor to have that, and the second most important, carry pagers. In other words, there was a work-life separation. Work could not invade your life. They could not contact you. You were uncontactable. The instant you left the hospital, they could not contact you. And that was me as a doctor in the 1990s. So our life has changed because now we're always on call. They can get you in a second on a variety of apps. In other words, work has invaded our home, our life. You can't escape it. And so what we're discovering more and more is a phenomenon that we need to rediscover, and it's called, we need to rediscover the third space. So not home, not work, but there's a third space. Not home, not work, but the transition between home and work, or the non-home, non-work times of your life, because we've lost them. In the last 10 or 20 years, because of email, mobile phones, apps, social media, we've lost this third space. So we need to recreate the third space in our life. So those of you in desktop publishing will know that a good page has a lot of white space. It's not cluttered with text. In fact, if there's too much text, the text becomes illegible and it works against the text. You actually need white space to make the text work. In Japanese art, apparently the space between the objects is important as the objects themselves. And we need third space to make sure our home works and our working life works. So how do we do this? We've got to find non-home, non-work times of our life, preserve them, maximize them, and proactively create them to make sure we have them. So for me, and I learned this from my friend, so did you know the reason our electronic devices rob us of sleep is not that we're on them at night, which we are, but we're on them first thing when we wake up. So that's one of the reasons we're losing one or two REM cycles. It's also one of the reasons why we've lost third space. So my friend, who's taught me this, he says, when I wake up and he wakes up in the morning, he does not turn on any device. Don't check emails, Don't read the Sydney Morning Herald because it's just going to be threatening. You know what I mean? And it's going to be your work trying to reach you. So don't go into social media because it will always be alarmist news. Don't read the newspaper. Don't check emails. Don't turn any device on. And make sure you spend at least the first 15, 30 minutes of your morning in third space. So for you, it could be a walk. For you, it could be meditating. For me, I've decided it's a coffee. And I'm going to, for me, I read a passage of the Bible. I pray. And then I exercise. That's my third space. And then you got to be good at looking for other ways of finding third space in your life. For me, it's commuting my push bike to work. And I just listen to podcasts as I'm riding my bike to work. And I'm in just this zen zone. And I know if a car hits me, at least I never saw it or heard it coming. And that's how I want to go. I don't need to know what's about to happen. So I'm in this zen world as I ride my push bike to work. Also, I find hobbies where you create flow. Flow is something that requires effort, but it's effortless and timeless at the same time. For some of you, it could be gardening. For me, it's doing slow cook barbecuing, which requires inefficiency and time and alone time. Like, leave me alone. And also, to make home life work, find ways to third space with the people in your life. So for me, I've got three young kids, and just what every parent dreads is that moment when they walk home after work, because they just come at you like, I'm not ready for this. And so I preemptively, proactively create third space for my kids. I say, you know what? This hour is going to be daddy time. So I'm not freaked out now they've invaded. No, it was always meant to be daddy time. So I just know for this hour, I'm going to daddy time. And also once a week, my wife and I, we third space with each other. We have date night. So it's our ritual once a week. And I know date night itself can become boring, its own little ritual. So what you got to do for date night to work is I pretend I'm 16 and it's a first date. And I'm trying to win her love for the first time. So I got to do something imaginative, creative, and dangerous. So last year we discovered it. It was open mic karaoke at the Manly Boat Shed the week before Christmas in front of the most drunken, rowdy, violent crowd where these lights are at you and you can't see anything except them trying to charge you and bouncers grabbing them at the last minute to stop them from crash tackling you. And we third spaced at 1 a.m. and that was just the adrenaline and the danger was our third space. Anyway, so that's just one thing I want to talk about, mental health, third space. Any questions? And this isn't my term. Like, if you Google it, there's a book by an Australian author and he's called it Third Space. Craig.
You're saying home isn't the third space because of family.
Housework. Yeah.
Responsibilities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's a personal time that's not with family, not with work. It's just your own.
Yeah.
Own time.
Yep.
So in that case, if we have friends that we would like to advise them to create a third space, how can we approach this? Or like, how can we raise this topic with them too?
Or how do you explain to your friends that you just need some alone time?
Oh, no, that they should have alone time.
Oh, they should have alone time. Oh, this is the difficult thing. How to tell someone to do something that's good for them?
Yeah,
you know, like an intervention or something. I don't know. Like it's how to give advice. Maybe just role model how it's worked, and then they might ask you, "Hey, what's different?" And they say, "Well, this is what we've been trying, and maybe you could try it." And I'm appropriating third space to make it not just mean alone time, but third space like with my kids. So we're not at home, we're not at work, they're not at school, but I'll take them to a park. Say I'm third spacing with them. When I take my wife out on a date night, we're third spacing because we're not at home, you know, doing the credit card bills. And it's not work, we're third spacing somewhere else. And I actually also recommend third spacing with your buddies. So once or twice a year, I catch up with these old colleagues of mine. We were work buddies in my last place of work, and we go on a conference and we road trip and we just go to restaurants, we watch movies. So we're third spacing with our buddies and work colleagues. You know how you make friends with people at work and you just never really get a chance to hang out with them because you're so busy and you promise you will, but you never will. And then if you just create a week where you third space with them, like go on a road trip or find a work conference and live off-site somewhere. So I do that once or twice here, I third space with my work colleagues. Yes? Oh, every day. It has to be every day. So as my friend and I are discovering, so I have this blanket rule. I do not switch on a device until I've had my third space for that morning. And then I also then convert my commute to a third space by just podcasting, being my Zen zone. So well-being is the buzzword right now, and for all the right reasons. Well-being recognizes that we are holistic. We're more than just atoms and molecules. We're more than the sum of our parts. So I still remember a cringe moment when I was working as a doctor at Westmead Hospital in the 1990s. In the emergency room, one of the triage nurses just went to the microphone and just said something like, "Could the asthmatic go to bed 3, please?" And you just cringe, you know, you'll be like saying, "Could the broken finger go to bed 8? And you just realize we are more than a disease. We're more than an organ. We're more than just a body. And that's what well-being is saying. We are more than just a body. That we have to look after ourselves holistically. And so more and more employers are realizing to treat their employees well. It's not just about paying them. It's not just about ergonomics, giving them a good desk. They need to look after their well-being. And some of those things we've already talked about, we need, you know, third space. We need to protect our home from our working life. We need enough sleep. We need enough exercise. We need to eat well. But then they go to a higher order. So well-being experts, if you start reading their books, the vocabulary goes into a higher order and they start using words like, we need purpose. We need thankfulness. We need forgiveness. We need meditation or prayer. And I'm going to end with another one, connectedness. And suddenly realize, wow, this is more than sleep. This is more than exercise. This is more than food. This is more than rest. We're starting to use metaphysical concepts here. Like if you do philosophy, you realize these are metaphysical rather than physical concepts. And they realize like for this is the higher order of well-being. We need these things in life. So the question was on work. How do we enjoy work? They've done so much study on work and they found out, you know what? It doesn't come down to what they pay you. It does come down to your workload. It comes down to, does my work fulfill a purpose? Is it making a difference, making this world better than how I found it? And so someone like Stephen Bidoff, in his book Manhood, says the highest rate of job satisfaction is found in healthcare and teaching. So, you know, nursing and teaching, they're the jobs that don't pay that well, but you have your highest job satisfaction in those two areas. And also, ministers of religion as well, because there's an obvious concrete purpose. Now there's purpose in all our work. It's just that in those sectors, it's more obvious, it's more concrete. And they're starting to say, and if your work feels like a calling, you've been called into this. This is my calling. This is where I should be. I'm a square peg in a square hole at this moment. They also say thankfulness. They say thankfulness. If you can say, be thankful for three things every day as a starting ritual, somehow you'd be much more positive in your frame of mind. And it's interesting, I drive my three boys to school every now and then, and because my dad had this ritual, I keep this ritual in the car, we take turns praying. It's always interesting to hear what we pray for. So when I was a boy going to school, we used to pray that, you know, we'll get good marks at school or this sort of stuff. But I've noticed my boys always saying, thank you that we had AFL yesterday. Thank you that we have friends at school. And wow, I realize all their prayers are thankful prayers. They just seem so much more positive and they seem more resilient. Apparently that is the end goal in well-being studies. You want workers who are resilient. And the more you sense a purpose in your work, the more thankful you are, the more resilient we will be. Interestingly enough, let me just riff here. In counseling psychology, they distinguish between stress and anxiety and burnout. So stress and anxiety can be from what I was saying before, where you just feel crowded with too much activity. So now you have an anxious moment. Now you can't will yourself onto a plane or train. And third space can be a way of just detuning, decluttering the background noise and anxiety and stress in our life. But burnout is not related to your workload. Burnout is related to this moment where you think, what is the point of this? There's a loss of purpose. Because if there's obvious purpose, you can actually cope with quite a high workload. But the instant there's no obvious purpose, it's what's the point of this? Viktor Frankl, in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, Holocaust Survivor, he says it's all about purpose. He says we're not after success, because what are we trying to be successful at? It's not about happiness, because that's just unfulfilling and self-gratuitous. It's actually, we need purpose, a calling, and that's how we survive, that's how we flourish. So if we can find those things at work, we will do well. Forgiveness, the ability to forgive. But metaphysically, this is very interesting, because we've been taught that we're just atoms and molecules and there is no such thing as right or wrong. Guilt is a social construct arbitrarily imposed upon us by authority figures like parents, religion, and the government. So there is no such thing as wrong. Just in the end, be true to yourself. Well, how can anyone wrong us if they're being true to themselves? But they have wronged us. So the whole notion of forgiveness requires a notion of right and wrong. And I think that's where we struggle, because we're struggling with the notion of right and wrong. And once there's no right or wrong, we ourselves can't find forgiveness. So that's a very metaphysical thing to think about right now. Almost every book I've read stresses the importance of meditation. There's an amazing book I've just read, Sarah Wilson. She's not a Christian author. Amazing writer. She used to be the editor for Cosmo Australia. She's behind the I Quit Sugar campaign, iquitsugar.com, and she's just written a book called First We Make the Beast Beautiful. So when my friend Andrew had his anxiety attack last year, couldn't get himself onto a train and can't catch a plane now, I asked Andrew, what is anxiety? You know, really, what is anxiety? And he said, you know, the best book for understanding anxiety that I read is Sarah Wilson's First We Make the Beast Beautiful. So I read it to try and understand what he was going through up there. And Sarah Wilson has a great way of describing anxiety. And she has a lot of tools to put in your toolkit for managing stress and anxiety. One of them is meditation. And she starts pushing boundaries. She says, I don't believe in a God, but it seems like there's a personal force out there in the universe. So for you, if it's God, pray. Like, because she doesn't believe in God, then she meditates. But it's almost like if you meditate only, you're leaving yourself short, because you're still just in your own little internal world. But if you can connect with a personal force in the universe, God if you want, then that's prayer. And then connectedness. It's Sarah Wilson I'm getting this from. She says, in the end, anxiety is this feeling where you're like a dog that's just circling a cushion, trying to find the right spot to lie on. You can't find it, so you keep circling, And in life then, you're always searching, thinking there should be something more, And it seems like we have a constant level of chaos we want in our lives. So the instant there's not enough here, we find it somewhere else. And that's what So people, like, they have a constant level of stress and anxiety that they create and recreate in their lives because you're always searching, searching for what? She says, it's this feeling that there should be a connectedness. But to what? Hugh Mackay, who's a social commentator, talks about, he's got a book called What Makes Us Tick, The 10 Desires That Drive Us. One of the desires is the desire for connectedness. Connecting with yourself, with your friends, with nature, and ultimately this sense that, you know what, there should be something more than this. Maybe there's a bigger story than just my own, a bigger purpose, a bigger calling. Maybe there's a personal force, a personal God in the universe to be connected with. So as I'm reading more and more of these authors on well-being, I'm sensing, you know what, for all this to work, we actually need a God. We need a personal, loving God of the universe, because who else are we being thankful to? Otherwise, you're just making this up for the sake of therapy. You know, okay, we should be thankful, but we're just atoms and molecules, and it's all just blind chance. Come on, what are we being thankful for? This is just a construct. But what if there is a person we're thankful for? This would work. What if there's a God we have wronged, and really we're after forgiveness, and he's happy to give it to us? That's a Christian story. Then that's what we're looking for. What if all these authors are saying we should meditate, but what am I meant to do when I'm meditating? What if I'm praying to a personal God? Well, that would work. And in the end, aren't I looking for connectedness, a story bigger than my own story, maybe a God to live for? Because Viktor Frankl says, in the end, the purpose and calling of life isn't to live for yourself, because that's empty and unfulfilling. It's to live for someone else. And in the end, God will be the ultimate someone else to live for. So I think physical well-being, mental well-being, and spiritual well-being, they're all connected. And in the end, I think we're wanting a God to be connected to be right with, to be thankful to, and to live his purpose, his calling. Maybe if I just end with this story. I love to go surfing, as you hear. And there was one Saturday, my wife and I were cleaning the house, doing a big Saturday clean, and I hate cleaning. It just sucks the energy out of me, like just soul destroying. Within 2 minutes, it's like my kids, my little kid, Jonty, who's six. I said, can you get the house ready? We're entertaining, we have people coming over. I don't know what to do. And that's how I feel cleaning on a Saturday. I don't know what to do. So I said to my wife, hey, I've got a brilliant idea. You seem to be energized by this. How about I let you clean? I'm going to go surfing. And when it's all over, we'll come back and we'll go out for dinner to celebrate. And she gave me the you can go if you want to answer, which a single guy sounds like a yes, you can go if you want to. But you married guys, no, that's a no answer disguised as a yes answer. Just go if you dare. So I didn't dare. I didn't go because I knew no matter how much fun the surfing was, I couldn't enjoy it. Not if I wasn't right with my wife, if I didn't have her blessing. And that's the ultimate well-being, isn't it? To have the blessing of someone you love. And if there's a God, to ultimately have his blessing. And I think that is the key to spiritual and mental and physical well-being as well.
You've been speaking partly from a Christian perspective. There are obviously other religions and spiritualities out there. Are you able to tell us why you've chosen Christianity for yourself?
Sure. Yeah, because a lot of these books leave it quite open-ended. So Stephen Bidoff, in his book on manhood, ends with a chapter on spirituality, but it doesn't say which one, you know, we should choose. Viktor Frankl, Jewish Holocaust survivor, says, in the end, he says, you know, we actually need a God for purpose of calling. And then he said, for you, it might be Yahweh, or for you, it might be the Christian God. So he leaves it open-ended. Sarah Wilson leaves it quite open-ended. A personal force of the universe called this force God, if you will. That's how she leaves it. So it's up to us to choose. And I read a great book on this. It was by Leslie Newbegin. He says basically there are two ways to understand spirituality. Two ways. There's one way of understanding it, and it's we're all on a journey. We're all on a journey looking for this. And in the end, we're all on a journey to spirituality or God or gods. Who's to say my way is any better than your way? Who am I to judge your religion, your spirituality, your journey? Because we're all navigating this as best we can on our own. So in this sense, it really does matter. It's open-ended. That's one way of looking at it. But the other way, and Leslie Newbegin says this is uniquely Middle Eastern. Instead of us being on a journey, God is on a journey to us. God finds us and reveals himself and says, this is who I am. So it's not us having to guess or judge or critique. It's simply God coming to us and saying, this is how it is. And so for me, that's the Christian claim. And there's a verse in the Bible in a book called John where it says, the Logos, the way, the word, the revelation became flesh. And he became one of us. Jesus, the Son of God, came and said, I am the way. So that's how why I know and I believe Jesus is the personal God that we're talking about here. Another way of understanding it is that elephant and the blind men analogy. You know, the elephant is in the room, literally, and all these blind men are feeling the elephant, trying to describe the elephant as best they can. One blind man feels a tail and says, I know what this is. It's a rope. One blind man feels a leg and says, I know what this is. This is a tree trunk. One blind man feels the trunk and says, I know what this is. This is a garden hose. But you and I know they're all describing the same thing, just according to their cultural context. And maybe it's the same with us. We're all actually describing the same spiritual force of the universe, but culturally flavored. So if you're born in India, it'll be Hinduism. If you're born in China, it'll be Buddhism. If you're born in the Middle East, it could be Judaism. All right, so that's one way of understanding spirituality and religions. But philosophers say there's several problems with this analogy, and it breaks down in a few areas. One area it breaks down is we can see it's an elephant. So we're saying everyone else is blind, but somehow I have a privileged epistemic vantage point where I, of all of the people in the universe, can see it's an elephant, but everyone else missed it. So it's actually me saying to the Muslim, you Muslims are believing the same God the Jews are. And they go, no, we're not. You're going to the Jews, and you are believing the same God the Buddhists are. And they go, no, we're not. Trust me, you are. I know your religion better than you know it yourself. So it comes across as tolerant, but actually it's a very intolerant way of understanding spirituality in religions. And another problem with it is assuming the elephant can't speak. So we're left to our blind devices. But if the elephant could say, I'm an elephant, that would solve all the problem. And that's the claim of the Middle Eastern worldview, that rather than us trying to guess and go on a journey and do the best we can with what we have, the elephant, God, comes and speaks, is a revealing God. And again, that's the claim in the Bible. John, the Logos, the Word, the speaking God, has come and said, I'm Jesus, I'm the way, I'm the Son of God. And so that's where I'm coming from.